Hello everyone and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. I am coming to you from Reykjavik, Iceland as always, where it is a beautiful, sunny, pink-skied summer night, very much unlike the game that I'm going to review this week, which is Still Wakes the Deep. I mentioned it last week, I'm sure you've heard about it if you follow new game releases. It is the latest from the Chinese Room. It is a horror walking sim type game set on a Scottish oil rig amidst a big storm. It was a really interesting game that I had some ups and downs with, so I'm looking forward to telling you all about that. But it's good to start the show with some new games, and I've got a few new games that I've added to the review slate for the podcast. One of them is Riven. You might know Riven as the 1997 Myst sequel. It was very, very well reviewed at the time and is thought of, I think, as a formative first-person puzzle game. I didn't play it back in the day, although I have played some of Myst and quite enjoyed what I played. But Riven has got a full remake with upgraded graphics and with new reworked puzzles and all sorts of things. It was vaguely on my radar, but when it dropped with a Metacritic 87, that really made me sit up and take notice. So I reached out and requested a copy. Thanks very much to the PR for obliging me, and I'm looking forward to trying out Riven, seeing what the fuss is about on this apparently top-class remake. There is also a huge Steam sale on right now. Steam really seems to be going off lately. I don't know if it's just because I have an ROG ally, so I'm paying much more attention to it. But between Next Fest and this giant sale, it seems like people are always talking about Steam lately. Maybe it's just me paying more attention. But I did pick up a few games in the sale from my wishlist. I tend to go to my wishlist, which I think has 70 games on it at the moment. Scroll down, see which games are really affordable, and pick them up, or pick up whatever I'm in the mood for. I bought three. I bought Grapple Dog. This is an acrobatic cartoon platformer. I hadn't heard of it. I missed the initial release of this game. But the sequel had a demo in the Next Fest, and I absolutely loved it. It's a really fun platform game where you're grappling around, you're jumping around, using weapons, exploring levels. Just a really, really, really good fun game. I wishlisted the original straight away, and it's on sale right now for $4, so I had to pick it up. It's clearly destiny, I think, for me to be a Grapple Dog, so I'm really looking forward to playing that one. I also picked up Mosalina. This is a 2D immersive sim. I think most immersive sims are 3D first person, but this one is side on, it's 2D, and it has simple looking graphics. I heard it recommended by Jeremy Jane over on the NoClip podcast, who said great things about it. And the description of this game is fascinating. The developer says that it's a response to the current trend of immersive sim design, where every ability is perfectly suited to solve a specific problem in the game. And they say that there is no premeditated solution to any given level for you to follow, so you're forced to get creative. I mean, that sounds super interesting to me. So Mosalina was just a few bucks as well. Looking forward to trying out that one too. The final game that I picked up is Pumpkin Jack. This is very different. This is a classic 3D platformer with a spooky Halloween kind of theme to it. I absolutely love old school 3D platformers. I grew up with Crash and Spyro and Mario Sunshine and all of those kinds of games. So I have a soft spot in my heart for this kind of game. We don't get a huge amount of them these days. This one was quite well rated when it came out. I've had it on my wish list forever. It was down to, I think, $5. So Pumpkin Jack is now downloaded to my ally. And I think I might save that one for a Halloween podcast pull. So expect to hear about Pumpkin Jack sometime this year. And as well as playing Still Wakes the Deep this week, I did also try out Times and Galaxy. This is the sci-fi reporter game from Fellow Traveller, where you play as the galaxy's first robot reporter. So it's kind of an adventure game. It's 2D, hand-drawn graphics. You run around. You are on the mothership, which is the office of Times and Galaxy, an intergalactic newspaper, and you have to go out and get stories, write them, and then come back. In the very first mission, you're sent to the scene of a spaceship crash. You walk around the scene, you can see the smouldering remains. There are some police robots around that you can talk to. You can interview eyewitnesses, which involves just asking them a couple of questions from a menu. There are some bystanders. There is a detective working on the case. So you talk to all of these people. You get a little pop when you get a new piece of information. You can also search the area for clues. And then you have to write a story. So the outcome of the level is, with all the information that you've managed to muster, you arrange the facts onto a newspaper page and decide what kind of story you're going to file. And each option that you have for the story has a different rating. So you can choose whether you would like to report dry and factual information, whether you would like to omit key facts, or whether you would like to sensationalise what is there. And the article will then get scored with a readership rating based on your choices, which I think are also going to have story outcomes from the looks of things. I really love the premise. I will say that straight off the bat, it's a little bit cumbersome to move around in. It's not exactly a slick play, but I do absolutely love the premise of this game. I really enjoyed that first mission, so I'll dip back into that one for sure. That's Times and Galaxy. So that's our intro block. It's a short one today, but before we get to the review, let me just mention this is a patron-supported podcast. So if you are a regular listener or someone who has just found the podcast today and likes what you hear, you can go to patreon.com/gamingindthewild to join the Patreon. It helps support the podcast, and you can pay as little as a dollar a month or more if you would like. For that, you get bonus episodes about all kinds of off-topic things about music, literature, travel. You get an invite to the show's Discord server, which is my favourite place on the internet to talk about games. There is loads going on in there at the minute. There is a single sitting social where we play a short game together every month and talk about it. There are some games of the moment channels. People are popping off talking about Shadow of the Erdtree at the moment. The Thousand Times Resist channel is still ticking along. And those change regularly, so there's always a place to talk about the latest games that come out. It's just such a lovely place to be. If you would like to join us and support this podcast, it's patreon.com/gamingindthewild. And I will leave a link for that in the show notes. So thank you very much to my existing patrons, and thank you very much to you if that's something you would consider. So with all of that said, let's get on with the show and talk about Still Wakes the Deep. So Still Wakes the Deep is developed by The Chinese Room and published by Secret Mode. It is out now for Steam, PS5 and Xbox, including Game Pass. And I will say that I initially tried this one on the ROG Ally, and the lighting system in the game wasn't working. Some of the areas looked really bleached out, dark areas looked pitch black. Very strange. I talked to Super Nintendad, friend of the show, who said that it was the same on their Steam Deck. So I reached out to the PR and asked for a PS5 code instead. Thanks very much to them for supplying me with one. The difference is night and day. On console, this is absolutely beautiful to look at, with deep shadows, weather effects, flickering lights. This is a game that is all about the atmosphere. So just to say that unless it's patched out at some point, I recommend skipping this one on a handheld PC, playing it on your tower PC or a console. On Metacritic, the game is currently sitting at a mixed or average 73. Push Square gave it 8. They said there is clear inspiration here from Alien and The Thing, and those inspirations play out through highly detailed settings and salt-of-the-earth characters. The Guardian gave this one a 6 and said that it's a horror game that creates great atmosphere with its acting and visual design, but is regularly brought to its knees by uninspiring gameplay. I think that your mileage on this game may vary based on your responses to how much you love the setting, which is spectacular, and how much you can deal with pretty limited and sometimes flawed gameplay. So a mixed spread of reviews came down at 73. How Long to Beat has this one at 4.5 hours. I played for 2.5. I didn't finish the game, which I will explain. And the developers described this one by saying, 1975, disaster strikes the Beira D oil rig off the coast of Scotland. Navigate the collapsing rig to save your crew from an otherworldly horror on the edge of all logic and reality. And my little capsule on this one is that it's a game distinguished by its setting. The Beira oil rig in 1970s Scotland is a new high for the Chinese Room's inspired environmental design, but the torrid gameplay is, at times, a new low. So I'm sure you can tell from that this is going to be a pretty mixed review from me on this one. There's a lot I like about the game, there's a lot that I didn't. And I will say up front that I generally like the Chinese Room's output. And this game has a lot of that DNA from their earlier games. I really liked Dear Esther. It's a walking simulator, one of the formative walking simulators that takes place in a loving recreation of a Hebridean island with beach trash, with pink heather, with lovely clouds and ocean effects. It's just a beautiful game. And the fact that it doesn't have much gameplay and it's mostly about walking worked for me in that game. It was a slow, melancholic play where you really do take in the location. Their second game, Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, is a loving recreation of an English village, exactly like the one where I grew up, almost exactly. It's almost creepy. It's another walking game. They tried to introduce some more gameplay there with this puzzles where you have to tilt the controller and you can explore a little and find clues. And it worked fine. It was still pretty minimal, but a very atmospheric game that I really enjoyed. This game setting is a loving recreation of a Scottish oil rig, and it's a wonder. We see the rolling seas below us. We see the fog rolling in. There is wind, rain, and weather. Everything feels wet and windblown. It's just beautiful. And it's really captured in some beautiful graphical details that you notice right away. As soon as you get out onto deck, you can see tarpaulins tied over things that are rippling and straining against the wind. They're really flapping fast as if they're going to break. It looks like these things look in real life. Everything about the oil rig is just vast. It's creaking, it's swaying. There is so much sound. There is so much beautiful use of light, so much beautiful texture and detail. And I think coming out onto the main deck in this game was a real wow moment for me. You could see the whole thing laid out before you, like that square in the middle of the top of an oil rig, with stacks of brightly coloured containers, bright yellow ladders going up and down between levels that are made out of metal mesh. There are walkways stacked with boxes and barrels, and there are bursts of fire from the gas flaring that light up the whole scene. And the interior too, it's just amazing. It feels really lived in. There are workers shouting at each other, sitting around eating, that sort of thing. Tools and mugs and clipboards, handwritten schedules pinned to the wall. It's just an amazing 3D environment to walk around. Shout out to the voice acting as well. It's set in Scotland and it's written in the Scottish dialect, which is awesome. Funnily enough, if you have the subtitles on, it will sometimes translate colloquial Scottish words into their English equivalent so that you can understand it. But I really like the fact that it included Scottish dialect. The sound design in the game is amazing as well. There's lots of groans and howling wind, the pattering of rain on metal. It's all just very much on point to get that atmosphere they were looking for. And I think it's all the more impressive because it's a period piece as well. So it's set in 1975. And it's very true to the time period, which gives it another layer of wonderful grain and texture. We get a little about the union politics of the time in the dialogue between the different rig workers. You can see it in everything from the newspapers, the layout and the colour, to the hairstyles and moustaches of these gruff oil rig workers, to the super detailed interiors. All of the bunk rooms have this orangey wood that is very true to the time. They have like crappy curtains and wrinkled carpets, and right through to the canteen furniture and all the ephemera that is lying around. It really does feel like it is of that era. Shout out as well to the effect of rain on glass in this game. It's the best that I've seen. You know, when it's raining softly but heavily, you get these little tiny droplets that sort of speckle onto the glass. And then every now and then they just flash into a black rivulet that takes all the water off the glass. And they nailed that. There is so much detail. It's lovingly created. So I think they did a wonderful job here on the setting and the era and the crew. But the game isn't just an oil rig simulator. It's also a horror game, as you are probably aware. And as such, it's a pretty good one. It's creepy. It's a kind of a disaster movie scenario as well. So you are on the oil rig at the start when the rig has a problem. It drills into something that it shouldn't be drilling into. The foreman screams at the workers to keep on drilling down. And what results is that the drill breaks off, they pull it back up, and it has pulled up a strange horror from the ocean floor. You see it towards the start of the game, so it's not a big spoiler. It's something weird and glowing and fleshy, like long fronds of some kind of strange sea plant, like giant alien seaweed. But the result of pulling that up is that it destabilizes the rig. So we get this disaster movie scenario where the rig is just coming apart. And it also unleashes an infection. Your crewmates start to lose their minds. And very much like the scenario of Dead Space, you have dual purposes in the game of urgent repairs to try and keep the thing afloat and survival and ultimately trying to get out alive. And I will say that I think that the first hour of this game is very tight, actually. Everything starts off fine and you're free to just prod around and look at stuff. I really enjoyed that level of freedom. You meet a lot of characters. It's Christmas time on the rig as well, so it's got that die-hard feeling with these sad little strings of fairy lights everywhere. The cook is making Christmas dinner and your character is in trouble with the foreman in the very start of the game. You have to go and see him. I really loved that scenario and that build-up. I think it was probably my favourite part of the game, actually. And then when the disaster hits, you have to climb under the rig, which is where you see what is happening. And then you have to creep through a really creepy section of game where you're going through some water tanks, and one of your crewmates is howling and gibbering. They've clearly done some bad stuff. There is blood around, and you never see them, but I thought it was very, very effective horror. So shout out to the start of this game. I think that the first hour and a half was really good, actually. But the gameplay is where this one comes apart a little bit. I think it's the part of games that the Chinese Room has traditionally struggled with the most. Dear Esther takes a lot of flack for being one of the original walking simulators, as I already said. I always kind of liked the purity of that game. You really do just walk, look, and listen. And it kind of worked for me. It was poetic and it was simple. Everybody's Gone to the Rapture had those other layers. This one keeps the linear format where you're really just walking from A to B. After the opening area, there isn't anywhere more for you to go. Like, you just have to follow the path of the game. There is only ever one way forward. But they've added more gameplay along with the walking this time. Because it is a monster type thing and your crewmates are going mental, you will have encounters with, I'm not going to spoil it, let's just say creatures, which includes some very basic stealth, where you're going to be creeping around a little bit. There are some chase sequences where you are running from people. But the stealth is very simple. It really amounts to crouching and hiding in a box until something has walked by and then going to the next box, and so forth. Sometimes you will get spotted and have to go into a chase sequence, or sometimes you will enter a scripted chase sequence where you are always going to be spotted and you have to escape an enemy before it catches you and kills you. This involves running through the dark rig, hitting X to vault over obstacles, hitting circle to crouch under things. You're not allowed to stop, really, or you'll be caught. And if you miss a turn, you're dead and you have to do it all again. It's all very dark and a little bit labyrinthine. There are doors that you cannot open, but you have to try them. If you try too many, you're going to die because you were too slow. So that deteriorated into a little bit of trial and error for me. It's also so dark that you just will miss turns. And if you are running at speed, maybe a little splash of yellow paint isn't quite enough to catch your eye and let you know where to go. So I found this more frustrating than scary. And I will get into why, but before we do that, between these dark horror parts where you are stealthing and running and listening to horrible sounds and getting a little bit nervous, there are also outdoor sections where you're out on the rig. And part of the game is the oil rig disaster that is unfolding around you. So as well as trying to escape, you're also trying to move between different areas of the rig. You get phone calls now and then, and it's someone saying someone has to go and turn off the gas flare, or this whole thing is going to go up, or someone has to go and restart the generator, or we're going to lose power, that kind of thing. You have to keep the lights on, you have to keep the radio working, you have to try and contact the mainland, and keep your chances of surviving alive. But the way that this plays out is you answer the phone, you're given a job, and the job might be go push a button on the generator. On the way there, there are minimal obstacles. There's a little bit of fire sometimes, you have to use a fire extinguisher. Then you just push the button and that's kind of the job done. There is also some platforming sometimes. I say platforming, you can't see that I'm doing air quotes, but the platforming in this game, it's real bad. You run forward and jump. Maybe you make it, maybe you don't. Maybe there is a QTE in the way. I died to more falls than monsters in this game. And QTEs I've spoken about before, but these are quick time events if you don't know. This means that something flashes up on the screen, a button prompt. Let's say you jump from A to B, your character almost falls, and then L2 flashes up on the screen. If you hit L2 and hold it, then you will pass the QTE. If you don't make it in time, then you will fall and die and have to do it again. I hate QTEs. I just do. I've never really enjoyed them in any game. They are often used, I think, to cheaply add tension or moments to a game. But they're a really cheap form of gameplay to me. You know, it's just like, if you don't respond fast enough, you're dead. It never feels good. I don't think they have ever been good. I don't think they ever will be good. And that definitely means that they are not good here. And I think that one of the reasons that I didn't like them, I don't like them just as a general gameplay mechanic, but I think in a game like this, which has tight pacing, where you are going from outdoor sections to indoor sections to scary sections and getting the story kind of given to you in this sense of, unfolding disaster. If you fail and die to a QTE and then have to redo a section of game, it really doesn't feel good. I think if the strength of the game is keeping you really invested and locked into the journey that you were on, the narrative thrust of the game, the pacing of the game, the building tension, I think that killing you off and having you do the same thing again, sometimes once, sometimes twice, whether it's a chase sequence, whether it's a QTE fail and a fall, it jams the brakes on the story. And it reminds you that you're playing a game. You're like, oh, it's like fucking Pac-Man or something. I just die and then I do it again, which really snapped me out of the moment. And we really are on a journey with Kaz, who is the protagonist of this game. We're trying to keep him alive. We're trying to keep the oil rig afloat. We're trying to survive. We're trying to get out and get back to our wife. And the fact that we get killed and reset, just kind of killed that for me. I was like, oh, I'm playing a game. And not only was I snapped into the gaminess of it all, but I was irritated by the poor implementation of platforming and QTEs in this game. And that did get me thinking about fail states a little bit. I was trying to think of other games that try to have stakes and the chances of failure, or at least a feeling that you could fail, or a feeling of precarity that adds tension and drive to the gameplay. Because stories need that, you know. They need stakes, they need interest, they need tension. I thought of a couple of examples. I thought about in Citizen Sleeper, for example, we constantly feel desperate for the medication that we as the character need to stay alive in this game. And it really does create a sense of precarity. If our condition reaches zero, then you can still play on. It's not a game over. You don't have to go back to the start of that day. You're weaker and you get to continue and you have to work harder to build yourself back up. So the story allows the game to continue when you fail. I think that is a very elegant way of doing it. It doesn't snap you out of that world. You're still in the experience. If you wake up in bed weak and someone has helped you, then you can continue. I also thought about Detroit Becomes Human, a very different game. That game has QTEs as well. But something that I actually enjoyed about that game is that if you are, for example, being chased through a house by someone that wants to enslave you, if you pass QTEs, you can slam their hand in the door, you can tip a table over so they can't get to you, and then maybe you can get out the back and escape. And the story allows for that. If you fail QTEs, like a sequence of them, like the three I described, then they'll grab your wrist. And then if you can't shake free, they will overpower you. And the story will account for that. And there are vastly divergent branching paths that become canon for your playthrough. The story allows for all of them, and it leads to really interesting life or death outcomes. So I think both of those games had like a quite an elegant way of playing into the strengths of the game. In Citizen Sleeper, it was the condition mechanics and allowing you to continue for story reasons. In Detroit Become Human, it was QTEs actually being meaningful. You don't just die and restart. You move on through the game, and they mattered, both of which I think are really cool. And it could have been really interesting if that was in Still Wakes for the Deep, you know. If you fail a QTE, then you maybe fall down a floor and you have to go through a different area that will link back up to the main story one way or the other. Or if there was some other kind of consequence, like if you fail a QTE to turn off a gas pump, then a crewmate doesn't make it. And you get like a different encounter somewhere down the line just to try and make them feel like they are a real part of the game, you know, rather than just sort of shoehorned in there, which is what it feels like now. And this might sound like armchair game design or something, but I don't know. I was just thinking about this as I was playing the game. I felt that the gameplay was not well integrated with the story. I felt that the gameplay that was chosen to be put in here wasn't in harmony with the intended effect or sensation of playing the game. So those were just some thoughts that bubbled up during my playthrough. So yeah, the gameplay in this game is not the strong point. I almost wonder if the more minimal Chinese Room games are more successful in a way, because I'm going to be blunt and say that beyond walking around and enjoying the setting of the game, no aspect of the gameplay here really worked for me. I think that the platforming, the puzzling isn't really puzzling, it's just switch pulling, And I think that the dramatic pull along of the story being broken up in the way that it is by fail states makes it feel more gamey, and therefore detracts from the dramatics rest of the game, which decreases the stakes and makes switch pulling feel just like obligatory feeling gameplay. And while I do applaud them for trying something new and for trying to, it seems like from game to game, they are trying to build up different types of gameplay to elevate their experiences and make them a little more involved. I applaud the ambition, but I think if that's the case, then fair enough. Good, and go for it. But something has to change, I would say, because the results here are really not it. So a mixed review from me here for sure, to go through the good things and the bad things. Top of the pile is the setting. It really is a big achievement. It is the strength of this developer to make arresting, engaging, detailed, lovingly created worlds. The rig is something to see. If you have Game Pass, I say play this game a little, just to take a look at it. It's really something to see. It really is. I love how much reverence and care has been put into every detail of this game. The visual environment is something really special. It's also a period piece, and it is very successful as such. The 80s oil rig, or 1975 rather, oil rig at Christmas is super compelling. It's a really interesting setting. The graphics in this game are great. The weather is great. I really did have the feeling of being out on a far-flung, remote, dangerous place. That's also helped by the audio design, the creaking, the groaning. As the rig starts to crumble, the sounds get really huge. The same can be said for some of the stealth sequences where you're creeping around and you can hear people gibbering or speaking in, you know, these echoing hallways. It was quite effective. You know, my heart rate definitely went up during those times, despite everything else that I've said about it. Also, the voice acting, proper Scots, really good stuff. The cast is amazing. The writing is excellent. I think the direction of the voice actors is really good. It sounds conversational and unscripted. If you're being shouted at by your boss, you really feel like he's mad at you. You can almost feel the spittle on your face. Some of the gruff mechanics, especially one female mechanic that has seen it all and is very practical, really, really convincing characters, really enjoyed that aspect of it. And I do also think that the opening section of the game is very well scripted, very well paced, and gives rise to some really tense moments. And I love the feeling in disaster movies or monster movies before you find out what's going on. There is always that wonderful ramp up, the unknown, the nervousness, and the hunger to find out what is up. So the first half of the game, I think, did that really well. As for the bad, I've talked about it a lot, so I won't harp on it, but the stealth, the chase sections, the switch stuff, going up and down ladders, trying to platform, and getting quick time events, it's all incredibly bad. Didn't like it at all. Not just sort of mid or boring or dull, but I thought actively bad and kind of annoying. It was bad enough to tank the game for me. There was a point at which I just decided to stop playing and watched the end on YouTube. I did skip through the latter half of the game. Most of it was the same kind of stuff, crawling around in the dark, a bit of stealth, flick a switch, and on you go. So I think given how little I was enjoying the act of playing the game, it was the right choice for me. And with that, I'm going to drop a small spoiler break just to briefly discuss the very end of the game. So if you haven't played it and you're going to, then you can either drop out here or skip forward about a minute. So I did watch the ending on YouTube, and it didn't make me regret not playing it. I skipped to the end, and I felt that the story petered out pretty predictably. Your character decides to sink the rig to save humanity from this infection, and then kind of walks into the light, has a flashbacky talk with his wife. No more visions of cosmic madness, no more transforming or becoming, no more of that Lovecraftian goodness. Just a little psychic wife chat and then credits left me completely cold, honestly. I think that the story could have been pushed further. So in the end, I didn't feel like it landed the story either. So that's my take on the game. I think it's visually wonderful. I think that the gameplay is not great at all. And I think that the narrative doesn't quite get where it's going. So this was a big miss for me. That's my take on Still Wakes the Deep. So I hope you enjoyed that episode. It was a bit of a negative review, not my favourite kind of review to do. I tried to give it a fair shake and explain my workings on that one, give credit where credit was due. I always do this little sort of apologising for my review at the end of the podcast when I do a bad review because I feel self-conscious about it. Thankfully, people have often told me that they value the bad reviews. Some patrons on the show joined off the back of a bad review. We had one off the back of 12 Minutes, one off the back of God of War Ragnarok. So people do enjoy the bad reviews sometimes. I personally prefer to champion games, but occasionally I play one that I have thoughts on that I would like to give. This was one of those. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to give me your thoughts on Still Wakes the Deep, you can find me on Twitter at Gaming in the Wild. You can also follow the YouTube channel. The podcast also uploads to YouTube now. So if you have YouTube Premium, listen to it on YouTube. It's there now as well as everywhere else. You are, of course, also welcome to join the Patreon. It's patreon.com/gamingin the wild. There is a link in the description for bonus content and invite to the Discord community to join the Still Wakes the Deep channel and see the debate that is going on there between other patrons and myself about the game. I'll be back next week with another episode. I will be giving the June indie preview and I'll be talking about some other games. Not quite sure what yet. I've got a lot on the slate. Maybe I will get into something nice and chill. Maybe something like Grapple Dogs is just the antidote I need after Still Wakes the Deep. But until then, take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.
Big news! The sale of the season is here. It's Wayfair's Black Friday sale, and it's on now. Right now, get up to 80% off everything home and everything you need for the season ahead. Save on quality furniture for every room in the house. Essentials for the guest room, whether it's new bedding or a new mattress. Kitchen and dining must-haves for all your hosting needs. And seasonal home finds like throw pillows and decor. Or favorites that you'll use all year long. And with amazing doorbuster deals from November 27th through December 2nd, you can shop the things you love at even lower prices at Wayfair. Plus, you can sit back and relax with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping. Everything home comes straight to your home. And the best part? Free delivery just in time for the holidays. This Black Friday, Wayfair deals are bigger and better than ever. There's no place like home for the holidays. And no place like Wayfair for Black Friday savings. So don't wait. Black Friday ends soon. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now and save up to 80% off at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Life is unpredictable. But preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to policygenius.com. That's policygenius.com.